We're seeing in the economy, in lots of different places, seemingly signs of inflation. Now, in fairness to the conversation, we've seen this a couple of times over the last 3 or 4 years where it feels like inflation is starting to pick up and then it just doesn't.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the Passive Income MBA Show, your source for learning about real estate syndications. Today, I'm so excited to welcome back Ted Green to our show. Ted, great to have you on.
It is always fun to be here. You're a gracious host, and it's my pleasure.
Awesome. Well, for those of you who haven't heard one of Ted's previous episodes, he works with Spartan Investment Group, and Spartan and Lux Capital, my investment firm, have partnered on several deals in the past and will continue to partner on deals going forward. We are working on a series with Ted that is aimed at helping our listeners understand the current investment climate, where we are in that climate, and why it matters to them. So today we're going to do a bit of a deep dive into the yield curve. And I'm going to turn it over to you, Ted, to kick us off with an overview of the yield curve.
Yeah. So thank you, Suja. So just to expand on where we're going with the series, you know, looking back over decades, various cycles, they come and various cycles go. And seemingly since about 1982, when the federal funds rate was at its peak at about 20%, since 1982 to today, thereabouts 39 years, interest rates have been on the decline. And things decline until they can't decline any further. And then you, at some point, will have a reversal. And maybe you're entering a different secular market than just quick, briefly. Secular markets are longer term markets, and cyclical markets are a series of shorter term environments that happen within a longer term secular market. So seemingly, the long-term secular decline in interest rates may be coming to conclusion. And so that begs the question, well, if that's the case, you know, what's going to happen going forward over the next 10, 25, maybe 40 years going forward? And so back to what we collectively wanted to title today's brief conversation, the yield curve. What is it? Why does it matter? We all hear snippets in the news, you know, the bond market did this today, or stocks did that today. And sometimes you'll hear commentators comment about the bond market. And so I thought taking a few minutes to just describe what the yield curve is, how does the bond market function, and what is it telling us about stocks, and what is it telling us about the cost of when properties are purchased, they're burdened by interest expense. So being aware of what impact that might have if we have a rising yield curve over the next couple of years. You know, those are all important pieces to the puzzle in our series as we work through the yield curve, as we work through inflation, effects on the stock market, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, so let's talk about the yield curve and what it is.
And just to kind of summarize what you've said so far, or maybe summarize part of what you've said so far. We are in, Ted kind of put some bookmarks on where we are as far as interest rates. And so correct me if I'm wrong, Ted, but interest rates peaked in 1982 and they have been on a somewhat of a declining trend until now, when they're at the lowest they've been in, I don't know if it's ever or just since I'm not sure since when, but they're extremely low right now. We know that. And so now what we're going to look at is what's going to happen with that. Are interest rates going to rise? We think that maybe there's an argument for saying that they maybe will rise. And what does that mean for properties that are going to be burdened with interest payments? And how does that affect stocks and bonds?
Yeah. Yes. So let's start with when people talk about the yield curve, what is it that they actually mean? Can that create a visual in our minds? So let's talk about bonds for a minute, and then we'll talk about this curve that bonds create. So here's bonds 101 as a throwback to college. Here's a crash course on bonds that might take a week in college to cover, and we'll do it in 2 minutes. It'd be interesting to see how this goes. So bonds sell in increments of $1,000. Bonds always have a coupon. That coupon doesn't change. Bonds have a set maturity. That doesn't change. And bonds are marketable. Another word for marketable is they are saleable. And so after issuance and before maturity, they're going to have a quote or a market price. So anyway, quick example, let's say the United States government issues a one-year treasury bond. And just for an easy example, let's say that the coupon is 10%. So this bond has a coupon of 10%. It's sold at $1,000. If interest rates drop, and this is admittedly an overly simplistic example, but if interest rates drop, because the bond has a coupon of 10%, meaning that on $1,000, it's going to pay $100 per year. And let's scratch the maturity of 1 year. Let's say it has a maturity of 10 years into the future. That'll compound the bond's price movements. So it was issued with a coupon of 10. It was sold originally at $1,000. It's got 10 years to maturity. And then interest rates drop for whatever reason. So the bond cash flows $100. That's constant. That doesn't change. But if interest rates have dropped, and then the bond owner decides they want to sell the bond, or maybe they need to sell the bond, the calculation needs to be made. Well, okay, wait a minute. If interest rates are now 7, so a new bond has a coupon of 7 or $70 per year, how do we determine the value of the old bond? And is the value of the old bond higher or lower than its par value or its original $1,000 value? So the answer to the question is, if interest rates drop, bond values go higher because you're getting, Suja, let's just say you own the $1,000 bond with a coupon of 10. So you're getting cash flow of $100 per year, and that doesn't change. If I want to buy a bond, I could go to the Treasury and buy a new bond, coupon of $70 per year, or I could buy your bond from you, but you're going to want a premium for the bond because interest rates have dropped. And that's the pricing, the actual pricing. Let's not get caught up in trying to calculate that. It's just the notion that when interest rates go down, because bonds have coupons that don't change, the bond's value is driven higher because in a declining interest rate environment, the cash flow from the 10% coupon bond, it's just higher than the cash flow from a newly issued 7% bond. So anyway, getting back to the yield curve and acknowledging that bonds move up and down in value, but the coupons are static, let's kind of parlay into what the yield curve looks like. So the U.S. Treasury will issue bonds that are of any maturity up to 30-year bonds. And I remember this was back in the late 90s when interest rates were a little bit higher. No, this was in the early 2000s in the recession after the dot-com bust. The Treasury was contemplating issuing a 50-year bond because interest rates were so low. They wanted to capitalize on, we'll sell some bonds, we'll pull in some cash. Admittedly, it's a low interest rate environment. Maybe we want to extend the maturity. So the point to all that is typically bonds from the government have a 30-year maximum. I can't remember if they actually issued a 50-year bond or not, but I remember it being quite a hubbub at Merrill Lynch when that conversation was happening. Back to the yield curve. So if we were to look at a bond, let's say it's priced at $1,150, Well, we would, to find the yield on the bond, we would divide the annual cash flow, that being $100, divide that by the market value of the bond, and that would give us the yield. So yield changes in accordance with the market value of the bond. Coupon is the number that does not change. And if we were to find a treasury bond that is 1 year old, 1 year to maturity, and then find a treasury bond that is 2 years to maturity and calculate the yield, and then find a three-year government bond that it has 3 years to maturity and calculate the yield. All of those yields for a one-year maturity, two-year maturity, three-year maturity, four, all the way up to 10 years, 20 years, and 30 years, if you write down that coupon and put it on a graph, you then see what those various maturities are yielding, and you can draw a graph of the slope of the yield curve. And this is where I want to get to, because it's the slope of the yield curve that's important. In every recession that I have been a part of, the yield curve has been flat or inverted. I'm in my early 50s. For a couple of decades, I did the whole stock and bond thing with Merrill Lynch and registered investment advisor. And so I've got some scar tissue from stock markets going up and down. Anyway, the point being, yeah, when we have recessions, it's very interesting to look at the yield curve and see what the slope of the curve is, because it's a tell, meaning when you get short-term rates that are higher than long-term rates, typically the economy is malfunctioning, and that's a tell. There's a couple of different directions we could go from here. Let's start with broad 10,000 foot level stuff. Generally speaking, the yield curve is going to have a slope about 165 basis points. That's just a broad multi-year average that I remember learning about in the early 90s. So typically, the yield curve's positive slope is 165 basis points. And let's explain that for a minute. In 1%, like the difference between 7% and 6%, there's 100 basis points. So if the general slope over history, if the yield curve slope is 165 basis points, that means it's 1.65%. So, and usually when people refer to the yield curve, they're referring to the slope of from the yield on a one-year bond to a 10-year bond. Sometimes people are referring to the twos and the tens, or sometimes people are referring to the 10 and the 30. Those are all just various parts of the maturity, the length to maturity. But typically, the 1 year and the 10 year is what people are referring to. You don't have a lot of differential in the yield of the 10-year bond and the 30-year government bonds. That's fairly uniform. The real slope or the real meat to the curve is found between the 1 year and the 10-year. Okay, so now we're all really smart because we've identified coupons don't change, yields change, because market values change. And if you divide the annual cash flow determined by coupon, which doesn't change, divide the annual coupon by the market value, that tells you your yield. Now, we had a recession in 2020. So in 2019, late 2019 and moving into the first part of 2020, we were all, for the first time, we'd heard a little bit about COVID, but you know, that was overseas. It wasn't really up in our grill. And in January and February of 2020, the 10-year government bond was yielding about 3%. Now, and that was after a really, really long time of trying to get the positive slope to the yield curve after the Great Recession, which was, as we all recall, you know, we lost Lehman Brothers, we lost Bear Stearns. We all, for the first time, learned what collateralized mortgage obligations, which, as it turned out, they had a lot of junk, you know, second and third position mortgages in them, which people couldn't pay, and the houses declined in value, and boy, it was a real mess. And it took from 2011, when we first started quantitative easing, actually, my mistake, quantitative easing by the Federal Reserve started in 2008. So I think we had QE1 and QE2 in 2008 and 2010. And that's when the Fed was actually going into the market and buying bonds. And now we're going to rely on that little lesson that we just had. So when you buy bonds, you're pushing the price up. When you sell bonds, think of it like cars that were being sold by the rental car companies about a year ago because COVID was now a thing and nobody was renting cars. So they sold them all. So car prices declined. Well, in the bond market, when the Fed is buying bonds, they're pushing bond prices up to do what? Keep interest rates down so that borrowing costs are low. They're doing their darndest to spur any kind of economic activity that they can. So anyway, we had the Fed very active in 2008, in 2010, in 2000, and well, I'm trying to recall, I think it was March of 2020 when COVID was really taking effect. They said briefly that they were going to be buying, I think it was $500 billion per month in treasury bonds. This is the Fed that's coming out and saying, we're going to buy $500 billion a month in treasury bonds in an effort to push prices up and keep interest rates low. And then like a week and a half later or 10 days later, they came out and said, no, we're just going to buy all the bonds we need to buy to keep interest rates in essence low. So the manipulation that has happened in the bond market has caused the Fed's balance sheet to currently it's about $7 trillion on the balance sheet. And back in 2015, I think it was like $4.5 trillion in the balance sheet. And what's so interesting about all of this is the Fed's balance sheet is the amount of lending capacity that banks have. And so banks have an unbelievable capacity to lend money and increase productivity in our economy, which is good. We need that. However, with all that money, that's money supply, with all that money in the economy, we're now, and you know, you see it everywhere. I want to be a little bit more precise with that. And I don't want to overstate to try and, I don't want to sound salesy. In a lot of places, we're starting to see buds of inflation or, you know, kind of think of springtime in the garden, you know, stuff starts popping up and it's fun and you get the smells going and it's cherry blossoms and all the rest of it. We're seeing in the economy in lots of different places, seemingly signs of inflation. Now, in fairness to the conversation, we've seen this a couple of times over the last 3 or 4 years where it feels like inflation is starting to pick up and then it just doesn't. And so we don't want to, I don't want to speak over with overconfidence that this time it's going to be real and it's going to stick. It sure feels like it. It may be a head fake. It may just kind of gradually slip back into nothing and we don't have inflation. Here's where it gets interesting.
Oh, yeah. I just want to circle back to something and just kind of sum up some of the stuff you've said. So Fed's balance sheet has increased from 4.5 to somewhere around 7, let's say. That was because of the CARES Act, correct? And the stimulus bills, the various stimulus bills. This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-C-A-P.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Yeah, I would say that the QE4, quantitative easing, where the Fed just decided with no reservation, we're buying as many bonds as it takes to keep interest rates, you know, near zero. Because remember, when our government needs deficit spending money, they issue bonds. So if there is no buyer, but the government needs money to run, volume comes on, going back to the used car analogy from the rental car companies a year ago, when they were selling used cars, when you got volume coming into the market, prices decline. Now, we know from 10 minutes ago in our conversation, bonds have a static coupon. When the price declines, that coupon doesn't stay, but it's the yield that moves higher. So when bonds go down in value, interest rates go higher. So if the Fed hadn't stepped in, because we are involved in deficit spending to a massive degree, you know, if the bonds go markedly down in value, interest rates will start to rise. And it's kind of like putting your hand, this is a grisly analogy, I may regret using, it's kind of like putting your hands around the neck of somebody that's struggling. You know, it's sorry for doing that to you, Suja, but you know, it's a damaging effect. And so the Fed said, well, we're not letting that happen to the patient, which is the U.S. economy. So we're going to give the patient as much breath as we can give it. And so the effect of the Fed buying bonds or the lack of buying bonds has a remarkable impact on the economy and the economy's ability to support us as a country. So did I kind of answer, did I speak to the question today?
Yeah, definitely. I think that there's two. So I just want to separate the two. So the federal spending that has happened is separate, obviously, than quantitative easing, but both have added to the deficit, correct? Just separately?
Yeah. So the Fed's purchase of bonds isn't part of deficit spending, but the deficit spending is what drove the necessity of the Fed to expand its balance sheet, which in turn expands the money supply, which in turn, that's what banks have the ability to lend. And so businesses can get out there and be more productive and do stuff. So it's not one and the same, but it's all very much interrelated. And what we really want is for the U.S. economy to continue to heal and gain momentum without overheating and causing inflation. Because, and if you'll permit me to run with this, I think we're, you know, this is the last three quarters of the racetrack that we're coming around, and this is where it really starts to make sense. Going back to 1968, which was when we had low interest rates, somewhat similar to what we have today, from 1968 to 1982, in general terms, that's when interest rates rose from about 4% to 20%. So that was Paul Volcker, who was the chairman of the Federal Reserve at that time. And during the 70s, you know, the hallmark of the 1970s, you know, that decade was known for inflation. And at some point, Paul said, and I forget the year, but he, you know, he's got to break the back of inflation. He raised short-term interest rates, which is the federal funds rate. That's the overnight interest rate that banks charge each other. So he raised interest rates to 20% thereabouts. And it worked in a matter of, I think it was 12 or 16 months. Inflation dropped from like 16% inflation down to 4% because he really constricted the economy. Now, what is so interesting about what happened to risk assets from 1968 to 1982? Remember that there was a point in 1982, and by the way, the decade of the 70s, very rough on the stock market, but there was a point in 1982 where the Dow Jones was at the same price it was in 1968. However, this is of critical importance, earnings had grown over the years, but the price to earnings ratio had compressed. So let's spend a moment on that because it can be very alarming for investors who have been framed by behavioral finance. And just a quick rabbit trail on behavioral finance, the study that was done in the early 70s, Kahneman and Tversky, I think, were the names of the two gentlemen that coined the term behavioral finance. And the notion is that your current environment frames your subconscious expectations of what is going to happen going forward based on what you've recently experienced. And as the longer that your recent experience has been familiar or consistent, so in other words, over the last 10 years, interest rates have been zero. I mean, is a number of my friends, if I ask them, you know, how much deficit spending are we doing on a monthly basis, they probably wouldn't know the answer because this has been going on for a decade. The point is, we've gotten accustomed to this, but if we're heading into a secular change in interest rates where now inflation is on the rise, we may be dealing with an environment, it won't be exactly the same as 68 to 1982, but it may rhyme with, you know, interest rates may move up by, I don't know, 7%, 10%, 14%. Now, this is really scary. Think about this. A lot of investors have been buying single family homes because interest rates are 2.5 or 3%, depending on your credit history. You got to come up a little bit more scratch for the down on a rental, but the concept applies. Well, what happens if interest rates move to 4% on the 10-year in a year from now and 7.5% on the 10-year government bond in 2 years from now and 10% on the 10-year government bond's yield 3 years from now? So what would a mortgage look like on a $2 million home, you know, in 3 years from now? And, you know, do families really have on average $275,000 income on an annual basis so that they can afford to buy $1.6 million or $1.5 million? I mean, you get the point. So if the interest rate expense is a bigger part of the monthly income, something's got to concede. And it seems to me like it could be price. So while looking backwards, we've all been conditioned when it comes to real estate, the carrying cost for that real estate is going to be relatively low because interest rates are low. But what if that's about to change? And what does that do to the investment model? Which is, it can be really scary when you have secular changes. You know, the stock market in 2000 went, I remember the NASDAQ in 2000 dropped by 70%, 70%. You know, in 2008, I think the S&P went down by 55% from 2008 to 2011. These can be really dicey times for investors. And so the notion that we're working on as far as, okay, syndicated real estate, maybe an investor is listening to this podcast right now who hasn't participated, who sees the potential internal rate of return and the pref rate of 7%. Well, you know, dear investor, go really slow. Make sure you understand all the jargon. What is a pref rate? Is it cumulative? How does the property, in the face of what potentially could be rising interest rates, how is it going to increase its net operating income so that it can defend its value and actually grow in value, even if interest rates are on the rise? You know, so the burden to the property may be higher in a couple of years if a refinance is needed. You know, but how can you still throw off more cash, which, Suja, as you know, in storage, you know, we like buying properties that are kind of gross, that are Class B or Class C, but where we can, you know, double the footprint, which means we're going to be, if we build 300 new units and they're dropping $60 per month per unit to the bottom line, I just know that's going to add $4 million of market value because it's NOI divided by the cap rate that determines the increase to the market value. So I'm getting a little bit off track here, but the sense is if inflation sticks this time around, and admittedly, we've had a couple of head fakes the last 4 years where commentators have said inflation is coming and then it kind of dissipates and never really materializes. It may be different this time. I think it is. In all fairness, I might be wrong. But if it is real, investors really need to have not just a lot of confidence, but they need to be bulletproof based on, okay, if this is a secular trend, if this is a trend that sticks for 10 or 15 years, where in general, interest rates march higher. And the way that can look is you get a run and then things go quiet. So like we had in January and February of this year, you know, the 10-year bond went, by way of a yield, it went from 0.75 to about 1.8 about 6 weeks ago, and then it's backed off. And I think here we are in early May of 2021, and I think we're at like 1.65 or 1.70% yield on the 10-year government bond. So it runs. It'll go for a run. It's kind of like gold. Gold is famous for running hard, and then it just goes quiet for a couple of months, and then it has a big breakout, 15 or 20% move, and then it goes quiet for a couple of months. And that's how the next 10 or 15 years could look in the bond market. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, Suja, I just threw a whole bunch of big, fancy $20 words at the wall. Tell me how I'm doing and what I can kind of sharpen or explain more.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that this has been extremely informative. We are right about at time, but if you can just spend like 30 seconds kind of putting a bookmark on this episode. That'd be great.
Yeah. So I think the most critical piece for investors, given where we're at today, is don't make your investment decisions going forward based on what you've seen in the rearview mirror the last 10 years. It can be a critically bad mistake to do that. So in other words, as you make your investments, ask yourself what your assumptions are. What do I think interest rates are going to do? What do I think raw material prices are going to do? Is my asset allocation correct? And let's just take 10 seconds on that. Dear investor, take your age, put a percent sign behind it. That's the percent of your net worth, just using long-term averages. That's the percentage of your net worth that should be in relatively safe investments. And I think that syndicated real estate assets in general, not just self-storage, that's my sandbox, but to a large degree industrial, I think there will be a real opportunity in retail in the next year or 18 months. So your age with a percent sign behind it, that's what you should have in relatively safe investments. And then your more risky assets is the difference of 100% allocation minus your age. So just be careful. If we are coming into a cyclical trend, the PE ratio on the stock market went down to 7 in 1982. So right now, the PE ratio on the stock market is in the mid to upper 30s. Can you imagine if the PE ratio of the stock market in 15 years were 7? I mean, that'd be like an 80% loss in price. I mean, that's scary to me. Mm-hmm.
Are you saying, and correct me if I'm incorrect, that what would classify as a risky investment?
Yeah.
Certain types of stocks.
Risk can come in from a variety of different categories. Illiquidity is a risk. So not being able to get out. In all fairness to the investor, our investments are illiquid. At the same time, we own the deed to properties and to businesses that have strong cash flow. So that's a different kind of risk. I'd say that risk is low, but illiquidity is a risk. The amount of time that you're illiquid, that's another flavor of risk. Whether or not you can be sued or can have a capital call, those are, risks to bear in mind. The likelihood of any of those events interrupting your business, I would say it's low. I mean, we had RV parks through COVID that service the oil field that have maintained their distributions. I mean, so I would argue in the worst environment that we could think of, one of those things was even hit by a tornado. We got it back on track and it's still making distributions. So even though you have risk, these things can still throw off cash. So a business can't handle risk, you're in the wrong place. So businesses are designed to handle risk. Let's see, I got myself off track again a little bit there, Suja. Remind me what your question was.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I think that this is a great place to kind of bookend this particular segment. I'll just do a quick wrap up, Ted, that, one of the things that I think both you and I like about commercial real estate, self-storage, and certain other types of investments is that they can do well in times of volatility and they, can continue to cash flow during a recession, during COVID, as you just mentioned with the mobile home parks. And yeah, there's something to consider when you're evaluating as an investor what the economic outlook is going forward, which is very important for all investors to have a certain degree of savviness. And that's kind of the goal of our sessions with Ted. So I know it might be a lot for some of you to try to process all of this information. And it certainly is, however, a worthwhile endeavor. I would say just listen to it again and continue to expose yourself to these concepts about macroeconomics, because it's super important as you develop as an investor to have a grasp on those. So thank you so much for this episode, Ted. Before we go, I'd love for you to shine a light on you, tell the listeners how they can get a hold of you.
Well, yeah, thanks for that, Suja. So I work for Spartan Investment Group. You can find us at spartan-investors.com. You can find me on LinkedIn. I do have an E on the end of green. We're about connecting with investors and explaining and providing granular data. And if an investor, finds comfort in what we're doing, we'd welcome them. And if not, we're just trying to be good community members and enjoy the relationships that we have with investors and Suja with you and your investors as well.
Awesome. All right, Ted. Well, thanks so much. And we can't wait to see you next time.
Sounds great. We'll see you.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.